From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! CNN's Military Connection. Why were Army PSYOPs personnel from Fort Bragg working in CNN Center in Atlanta? We'll have a discussion with Alexander Coburn, Vernon Eason, president of CNN International, and the Dutch journalist who broke the story in Yugoslavia. And as Oscar night approaches, a conversation with a black film director who's suing Hollywood. He applied for over 2,000 jobs and was rejected every time. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Peace activist Philip Berrigan was sentenced to another 30 months behind bars for damaging warplanes. Berrigan and three co-defendants, including two women and a Jesuit priest, got stiffer sentences than prosecutors wanted for their role in breaking into a Maryland Air National Guard base last December 19th, spraying two A-10 Warthog assault aircraft with blood and taking a hammer to a third. Supporters say the act was intended to protest the use of depleted uranium in missiles fired by the $8 million A-10 jets, a low-level radioactive heavy metal. The depleted uranium enables missiles to pierce tank armor. Baltimore County Circuit Judge James Smith said the amount of damage caused by the protest took the case outside normal sentencing guidelines. But Berrigan's wife, Elizabeth McAllister, and also a well-known peace activist, said the judge went very, very far outside the guidelines in a very, very vindictive fashion. The Reverend Stephen Kelly, a 50-year-old Jesuit priest from New York City, Susan Crane, a member with Berrigan of Baltimore's Jonah House community, received 27-month sentences on conspiracy and malicious destruction charges. Elizabeth Walls, a Catholic worker from Philadelphia, was sentenced to serve 18 months in prison. The Justice Department is turning up the pressure for the speedy return of Elian Gonzalez to his father in Cuba. The Miami Herald and Washington Post say government lawyers have set a deadline of noon today for Elian's Miami relatives to agree to an expedited appeal of a federal judge's decision against them. A letter to them says if they don't, the government is going to immediately move to revoke his temporary status. The judge this week upheld the authority of Attorney General Janet Reno to send the six-year-old child back to his father. Elian's Miami relatives have been fighting to keep him in the U.S. over the objections of his father. A judge threw out six more criminal convictions yesterday as part of an ongoing probe into Los Angeles's police corruption scandal, bringing the total to 46. Superior Court Judge Larry Fidler dismissed the six cases at the request of the district attorney's office, which said the convictions were obtained after officers falsified evidence, committed perjury, and employed other illegal practices. The Justice Department has launched a criminal inquiry into the White House's mishandling of email correspondence that may have been relevant to congressional and independent counsel subpoenas on matters ranging from campaign fundraising to the Monica Lewinsky scandal, according to the court papers today in the Washington Post. At issue in the justice probe is the White House's response when officials there learned in 1998 that a computer system, apparently because of inadvertent programming errors, had failed to keep an archive of thousands of emails sent to some 500 White House employees from outsiders. In a separate computer problem, whose dimensions were revealed for the first time yesterday, the White House counsel disclosed that a vast quantity of email from and to Vice President Gore and his staff was never properly recorded and therefore was never reviewed to determine if it was relevant to investigations of Democratic fundraising abuses in 1996. Spurred by complaints from two disabled District of Columbia residents, a civil rights group has filed a class action lawsuit accusing Ames department stores of failing to make its aisles, counters, and dressing rooms accessible to people using wheelchairs. The suit alleges the discount retailing chain has not complied with the Americans with Disabilities Act and has violated state and local laws. Lawyers say the allegations were triggered by an Ames store in Northeast Washington and that a survey of 50 other Ames stores across the nation revealed similar problems. The popular nighttime heartburn drug Prepulsid will be pulled from the market after being linked to dozens of fatal heart rhythm abnormalities. This, according to federal regulators, the removal is the second this week of a widely used prescription drug. The FDA announced that after consultations with Janssen Pharmaceutica, the company decided to stop marketing the drug as of July 14th. Propulsin's been linked to 341 reports of heart rhythm abnormalities, including 80 deaths since coming to market in 1993. The fatal shooting of a black man by New York City police has taken center stage in the U.S. Senate. The death alone stirred anger in New York City's communities of color. But New York City Mayor Giuliani's release of Patrick Dorisman's sealed juvenile record and his repeated suggestions the man was responsible for his own death have evoked protest in the middle of what's expected to be a close contest. Some Republicans are wondering what political benefits lay in Giuliani's refusal to express sympathy to the family or meet with community members. The Reverend Jesse Jackson is in New York questioning Giuliani's sanity. He said there's something that's not well about his response to unarmed people being shot by police.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a
40% of the stations carried no news of the world.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Colt, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
And experience your psychic connection.
We don't have shit to say. We don't have anything to do.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Flim flam diagram, data jam, handicap caught it. Yo, you bought it. A mind is a profitable thing to waste. You want another taste, baby? Got news good.
What we need to know.
News good.
What we want to know.
News good.
What we think we know.
News Goo from the CD Polarity here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country at the end of another hectic week in the news.
That's right, and today we have a very interesting show ahead of us. Yesterday, there was an interesting piece in the San Jose Mercury News with allegations that once again the line between the mainstream media and the military has again been blurred. Alexander Coburn is the author of the piece, and he writes, "A handful of military personnel from the 4th Psychological Operations Group, known as PSYOPs, based at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, have until recently been working in CNN's headquarters in Atlanta. An enterprising Dutch journalist named Abe de Vries came up with this important story in mid-February, and he remains properly astounded that no mainstream news medium in the United States has evinced any interest in the story." Coburn's piece goes on to say, de Vries later told me he'd originally come upon the story via an article in the French intelligence newsletter, which described a military symposium in Arlington, Virginia, held at the beginning of that same month, discussing use of the press in military operations. We're joined right now by three people to discuss this issue. Abe de Vries is with us from Belgrade, Yugoslavia, the Balkans correspondent for True, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, a leading Dutch daily. We're also joined by Alexander Coburn, a well-known national columnist and editor of the newsletter Counterpunch. And on the phone with us from Atlanta, Georgia, is Eason Jordan, president of News Gathering and International Networks for CNN. Let's begin with Abe de Vries. Can you tell us how you first learned of the story?
Hi, Amy. Yes, I can. You know, I am subscribed to this internet site of the French intelligence organization, which is called Intelligence Online. And as every day, you know, I'm visiting a lot of internet sites, and I came across this short article of a French correspondent at the military symposium in Arlington. And somewhere in the middle of the text, there was some American colonel, and he said in one line, "Oh yes, we had also we have a very good cooperation with the people from CNN." And then I thought, "Well, what is this?" You know, I thought this is worth looking into. So I decided just to call the people in Washington from the U.S. Army Information Service, and I called also CNN. Well, and that's how it started.
Well,
and in terms then, after you reported it, Alexander Colburn, you picked up the story here in the San Jose Mercury, first in Counter Punch, but then in the San Jose Mercury, and you remarked that there's been very little attention paid to it by anyone else in the media in this country.
I think Abe's excellent stories have made their way onto the internet, where I saw them. And actually, initially, there were two stories. Initially, there was one story he'd done, I think, on February the 21st. And I did that in Counterpunch, bringing it up. And then I do a weekly broadcast to South Africa, and I mentioned the story there. And I guess the CNN office in Johannesburg listened with some interest to this story about how some interns had been in from PSYOPs had been in the CNN headquarters, and they called their headquarters. And then Mr. Jordan, I believe is one of your guests this morning, rang me up in considerable indignation, saying this is a terrible slur on the good name of CNN and on the quality of its news gathering. But it did actually turn out that indeed there had been these interns. He says that the CNN maintained stoutly, of course, that these interns did all, you know, they just were there, you know, making coffee or looking around, and they had no role in actually making news.
Well, let's actually bring Easton Jordan into the conversation to tell us what role the members of Army Psychological Operations personnel from Fort Bragg played at CNN. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. They functioned as interns here. They functioned as observers. They were always under CNN supervision. They did not decide what we would report, how we would report it, when we would report something.
Were you paying them?
No.
And what were they doing there?
They were functioning as observers in three different units of this company, starting on June 7, 1999, for a few weeks at a time. I think they came one at a time. And they worked in three parts of the company in our radio, and I should be clear, not work. They did not work. They did not function as journalists. They were not paid, but they were in our radio department, our satellites area, and our Southeast Bureau.
Well, Mr. Jordan, given the enormous influence that CNN has internationally, obviously, as well as in this country in terms of news gathering, would you be surprised that some people might question why a military unit that is specifically geared toward disseminating information from the military's point of view, why they might have such interest in working at CNN, even for temporarily?
Certainly the question is appropriate, and the answer is a simple one. They should not have been here. They're not here anymore, and they will not be here ever again.
But can you talk about what went into the consideration of having them in the news operation to begin with? What was the idea of having them observe? What did they want to learn?
Well, they apparently wanted to come and observe to see how CNN functioned, as a lot of people from around the world do. We have observers here from all over the world. Yesterday I hosted a group including members of the Bulgarian military. We have 10 journalists, actually 15 journalists here now from around the world, from Russia, from China, and many other countries. And they are in, these journalists who are visiting are here for a full month. And believe me, we've hosted hundreds and hundreds of journalists from around the world for weeks and weeks at a time. And if they were true evidence that the U.S. government or any government had undue influence on CNN's coverage and reporting, you would hear about it in a very big way. There's no evidence of that.
What made you decide that they shouldn't have been there, that you made a mistake in bringing PSYOPs personnel into CNN?
Let me be clear. News gathering, no one involved in news gathering at the leadership level was aware that this program had begun, and as soon as we found out about it, we put a halt to it within a matter of days. We were a bit confused by the initial reporting, because the initial reporting was that these people were employed, that these people were here during the Kosovo conflict. In fact, the very first one started June 7, and the Kosovo conflict ended June 9. So clearly they weren't even here, really, for 99% of the Kosovo conflict, but they had no role whatsoever in our Kosovo coverage, and in fact had no role whatsoever in any of our coverage.
Alexander Colburn.
I think one of the things that should be pointed out, obviously, and not to challenge what Mr. Jordan says, is that the Army was sufficiently elated by the presence of these gentlemen. Were they all men?
No.
Well, these people. I didn't. What? There were how many women and how many men?
I think it was four men and one woman.
Okay. Well, there are these four men and one woman. The army was obviously pleased about it because we have, as quoted by, actually by Intelligence Online, Colonel Christopher St. John, the commander of the 4th PSYOPS group, you know, mentioned it at this propaganda powwow in Washington. So the army obviously thought it was not just a matter of having five people who were, you know, standing around the studio, but this was something worthy of comment in a conference later on. So from that point of view, I think the story, I mean, it may well be true that CNN, I wrote in Counterpunch that it could be that CNN was the target of a PSYOPS penetration, was too naive or too inattentive in some ways to notice. That could very well be true.
Sure, Mr. Jordan.
This is not a Tom Clancy spy novel here. This is, let's deal with facts. Mm-hmm. I oversee news gathering at CNN, and I'm here to tell you there is no way that PSYOPS personnel had an influence on CNN's coverage, period.
No, I don't think it's quite a matter of saying, you know, that in 2 weeks a PSYOPS person suddenly cunningly introduced U.S. Army propaganda into some newscast. I don't think, actually, to be blunt about it, in the cost of everything, he had no need to. But the question is really, you know, the way these things work, if people come to an office, then they make friends at the office, then the next time they want to know something, they know someone they can call up. A relationship is a much more subtle thing than someone suddenly running in and writing Armand Poor's copy for her.
But at the same time, Alexander, knowing how many of these huge media corporations work, sometimes there are other areas of a company, a business side or executive side, that makes an arrangement that people on the editorial side have no knowledge of. And this appears to be, at least from what Mr. Jordan says, what happened in this particular situation.
Who actually made the deal, Mr. Jordan?
Deal was done through our human resources area, through our internship.
Again, one must say, and I don't want to, I mean, obviously not say that Mr. Jordan's saying untrue, but people, when these embarrassing situations come up, you know, people tend to say, well, of course, this was well below our radar screen and we had nothing to do with it. It may well be true. However, I have to say another thing, that when Mr. Jordan rang me up and was initially giving me a rousing for reproducing De Vries's excellent story, I mean, the implication was that there should, that CNN really was totally above suspicion of complicity with the Pentagon at any level. And I have to say in a more general way that the reason why this story, I think, has struck a chord is that many people, for better or for worse, regard CNN, particularly in the Kosovo conflict, as having played rather more of a role than the mere disinterested reproducer of fact, as having been a major force in stoking up popular emotion about that war. And I always say it's summed up in the relationship between Christian Amanpour, one of your major foreign correspondents, and actually her husband, who is was at that time the major propagandist for the State Department. Now, that's not to say that Amanpour isn't capable of making her own decisions, but I think that appearance of unity in putting a particular line does raise, or for many people, symbolizes CNN's reproduction of government propaganda.
Mr. Jordan, would you care to respond?
Oh, I think that's nonsense. Christiane Amanpour's reporting speaks for itself, and she's an independent journalist who, you know, upholds the highest standards of journalism and is somebody who is widely recognized as a tremendous journalist, has been honored around the world for her reporting achievements.
I wanted to read to you from the psychological operations literature. I want to say that we had hoped to have on someone from PSYOPS, but they decided not to come on this morning. But it starts off, again, this is from psychological operations, with a quote, "Capture their minds and their hearts and souls will follow." And it says, psychological operations, or PSYOP, are planned operations to convey selected information and indicators to audiences to influence their emotions, motives, objective reasoning, and ultimately the behavior of organizations, groups, and individuals. Used in all aspects of war, it's a weapon whose effectiveness is limited only by the ingenuity of the commander using it. A proven winner in combat and peacetime, PSYOP is one of the oldest weapons in the arsenal of man. It's an important force, protector, combat multiplier, and a non-lethal weapon system. We have to break for stations to identify themselves, but when we come back, I wanted to get your comment on that. We're talking to Alexander Coburn, who is editor of the biweekly Counterpunch, a political newsletter and well-known national columnist. Also, Eason Jordan is with us. He's the president of CNN International. And we're joined from Belgrade by Abe de Vries, who is a Dutch reporter who first broke the story of PSYOP's personnel interning at CNN in Atlanta. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests, the president of CNN International, Eason Jordan, Alexander Coburn, national columnist and editor of Counterpunch political newsletter, and Abe de Vries from Belgrade, a Dutch reporter who broke the story of the PSYOP's interns at CNN. Eason Jordan, I wanted to ask you a question about the bombing of RTS, Radio Television Serbia, that happened at the end of April in 1999. I actually was with you at an event, though you might not have known it. It was the Overseas Press Club Awards dinner in New York City, where Richard Holbrooke was addressing the journalists who had come together for this honoring of journalists. And he said, I have just learned from Eason Jordan, the president of CNN International, that NATO forces have just bombed Radio Television Serbia off the air. And we went back to our offices that night afterwards, and we saw the body parts being pulled out. And I wanted to ask, since CNN worked out of RTS as well during the bombing to, I guess, satellite your stuff up and everything, if you knew in advance that NATO was going to bomb RTS?
We knew that in advance, and I think much of the world knew it in advance, and certainly the Serb leadership knew it in advance. And CNN has condemned that bombing and is very sorry that it ever happened and certainly never would have wanted it to happen, and we feel terrible that it did happen.
So you were alerted that they were going to bomb Radio Television Serbia that night?
Not that night in particular, as far as I can recall, but I can tell you that not only was it widely known that the bombing was going to take place, but the Serb leadership organized demonstrations outside of RTS to protest the impending bombing of the TV station.
So you were able to get your personnel out of CNN, your CNN personnel out before the bombs fell.
That's correct. And the tragedy in this is that the Serb leadership knew the building was going to be bombed, not necessarily that night, but the Serb leadership knew the building was targeted. And the head of Serbian TV, Mr. Milanovic, who I've met, I've been to Belgrade, and I was there during the war, he ordered his employees to stay in that building and said they would be fired and they'd lose their pensions if they did not report to work in their headquarters building, which was targeted for bombing.
Now, you must have known it was that night, right, because personnel were in on other nights, but you made sure that they weren't there that night.
Our people had been out of that building for several days before the bombing took
place. Can I ask a question, Amy?
Yes, Alexander.
Actually, under the protocols of war crimes, I mean, that bombing, as it was planned, was a war crime. This was involving civilians. It's very clear. So all the people who knew, and I'm not making an exception of the CNN directorship, every correspondent who knew, I mean, every news organization in the West knew, by not saying, reporting on their media, we know for a certain fact this is going to be bombed. We know the time. We've asked our people out. They were, to that extent, accomplices to a war crime, were they not?
That is ridiculous.
Why really? Is it ridiculous? It's not ridiculous at all. If you knew that a news thing was going to be bombed, I mean, many of the bombings by NATO, not that you'd know this from CNN, I might add, many of the bombings were actually war crimes. They were direct attempts to inflict suffering on a civilian population. And the bombing of a news outlet was similarly a war crime. And it's not ridiculous to say that you were party to it. You were.
Well, Eason Jordan, let me ask you this. Robert Fisk, who is a very respected award-winning journalist with The Independent in Britain, who's been based in Lebanon for about two decades now, did a column where he said that that night, Alexander Vucic, who is the Minister of Information, was going to be interviewed by Larry King. And so he would be going to RTS studios. Larry King is on Eastern time about 9 o'clock in the evening. And it was only because he was late that he was not caught in that bombing. I've just been giving the story right now. It says, 2 days before NATO bombed the Serb television headquarters in Belgrade, CNN received a tip from its Atlanta headquarters that the building was to be destroyed. They were told to remove their facilities from the premises at once, which they did. A day later, Serbian Information Minister Alexander Vucic received a faxed invitation from the Larry King live show in the U.S. to appear on CNN. They wanted him on air at 2:30 in the morning of April 23rd and asked him to arrive at Serb television half an hour early for makeup. Vucic was late, which was just as well for him since NATO missiles slammed into the building at 6 minutes past two. The first one exploded in the makeup room where the young Serb assistant was burned to death. CNN calls this all a coincidence, saying the Larry King show put out by the entertainment division did not know of the news department's instruction to its men to leave the Belgrade building. Can you talk more about that? The Minister of Information invited to those headquarters that to RTS that night and only missing the missiles because he was late?
First of all, it's important that we not believe everything we read, and the article is inaccurate. I'm sorry. I was here. I was in charge of the coverage, and I spent a lot of time in Yugoslavia as well during the war, and I know the realities of the situation. Minister Vucic canceled his appearance on the program 12 hours before it began. That's the reality of the situation. An additional reality is, both in Brussels and in Washington, U.S. and NATO officials made it emphatically clear weeks in advance of the bombing that all Serb media outlets were being targeted by the U.S. and NATO. So there's no mystery here. Now, Serb TV and the Serb officials were not staying away from Serb television knowing that it was a target, and it was the only way from we could originate transmissions from Belgrade at that time. So we had standing offers to Serb leaders who routinely visited the building knowing that it would be targeted, just as I was in Belgrade. I went to buildings that I knew were targeted. That's a risk that you run in war zones.
But you must have known that it was happening that night. I mean, No. You really would have had to clear your people out to make sure they were not
Our
there.
Our people had been cleared out of there days before, and I did not know, and CNN did not know it was going to happen that night.
Since you said that NATO had warned you, saying that the Serb television station was targeted, did you broadcast that? Did you do stories on that?
NATO warned the world. Why do you think Serb TV was organizing demonstrations outside of its building?
But did CNN do stories on that, as you said that you had protested it?
Absolutely.
Well, I'd like to, just in wrapping up this segment, to ask Abe DeVries from Belgrade, what has been the response in other media in Europe to your initial reporting on this CNN PSYOPs relationship? Even though it's clearly been discontinued, and that the editorial managers at CNN have disavowed it.
Well, you know, to my knowledge, no European medium outside my own newspaper, Trouw, did anything with it. You know, it was covered in the United States by a number of internet sites, the Emperor's Clothes being the first, but in Europe I didn't notice any reaction. And of course this is a bit strange, you know, because there is a central point in this whole discussion which is not mentioned until now. I didn't try to prove that CNN, that the military at CNN had any real influence. The only point was they were there. And for a big news organization, you know, trying to present itself as independent, as having no interests in common with the military people, with the Pentagon, it is unbelievable that there were these kinds of close contacts. I mean, you have to avoid the appearance that something is wrong, right? Well, that is what I wanted to make clear in my articles.
Eason Jordan, I wanted to ask you another question that I did have a chance to ask Christiane Amanpour and also Frank Cesno, actually, that night at the Overseas Press Club dinner when NATO forces bombed RTS. And that's this. It's the policy of not just CNN, but all of the mainstream networks of putting retired generals on the payroll to comment in times of war and not to also have peace activists, peace leaders, analysts on the payroll to also be there throughout to be commenting, to provide a counter point of view.
Well, I'm unaware of any CNN policy in that regard. In wartime, we want people who understand how wars are orchestrated. We want experts who can address those issues. And if we have not put peace activist on the air, that's not because we have some policy against that. To the contrary, there's no more greater a peace activist and globalist in the world than the person who oversees CNN, Ted Turner.
But on this issue of the retired generals, why have them on the payroll? The Pentagon is certainly more than willing to put out its point of view for free.
Because we want people who can provide insight that is not being provided necessarily by the Pentagon.
Well, more often than not, they're being used to talk about whether, you know, there should be continued airstrikes or whether they should escalate to ground troops. These are political issues. They're not specifically technical issues. Why not have peace activists for each retired general you have on the payroll also there?
I mean, this is an issue very different from the one I thought we were going to discuss.
Right,
but certainly we're committed to balance, and if in any way we fall short, we need to redouble our efforts to make sure we're balanced in that regard.
Well, in general, even though some of these questions have been a little bit off the main topic of PSYOPs, I think they all deal with this question of an independent organization like yours that has so much influence worldwide that its relationship to the U.S. military in all of its manifestations, whether it's with PSYOPs interns, whether it's the use of generals as color commentators for war, or whether it is of your relationship and information that you get from the military, it's all within the bounds of that for you to be able to provide objective news coverage, the public has to have confidence that you are not being unduly influenced by the American military in these in times of major conflicts. Don't you agree?
Absolutely.
Can I make a point, Amy?
Alexander Coburn.
I mean, let's look at this the other way around. Supposing that, in fact, there was an incredibly successful military penetration of CNN. Supposing, for the sake of argument, that everything Eason is saying is nonsense, and that, in fact, this has been a very long Pentagon program, and that actually PSYOPs have an extraordinarily close relationship. I'm just hypothesizing. How would you disprove that? Because, after all, everything you see on CNN would buttress that conclusion. CNN was an ardent advocate of the war through Amanpour's, I think, vastly inflated reporting from Kosovo. It did not report. CNN actually rather carefully omitted reporting on, let's say, the approaches to the war, what the U.S. and NATO were forcing Yugoslavia to do at Rambouillet. They actually, I think, suppressed oppositional opinion in the United States. They did not give a balanced point of view. They fueled at all points the Pentagon, State Department, White House approach to the war. I think you could demonstrate that far beyond the confines of your program, and it's been done by a number of people. I'm just saying that if you looked at it objectively from afar, actually what you could see is evidence of an enormously successful PSYOPs operation. So in a way, the burden is far more on CNN to disprove what you could conclude was a successful operation. I'm just putting this because I think this is coming into a terrain where Mr. Eastern Jordan is obviously maintaining his point of view because he's paid by the organization. Did Ted Turner, he mentioned Ted Turner, did Turner, who's the boss, actually go on CNN and raise peacemaking concerns? I don't particularly care what Ted Turner thinks in the privacy of his own home. CNN, as an outfit, both in Iraq and now, is, to my view of thinking, devotes about 95% of its time in times of war to putting the U.S. government point of view.
Eason Jordan, president of CNN International.
Right. It's impossible to respond to all those ridiculous allegations because I got to tell you, it's hard to prove a negative. And, do you want to come to CNN, Andrew, or anybody else? You know, come on to CNN. Spend weeks here if you want to and look for the evidence of these conspiracies.
I don't need to come. I can turn on my television set.
Well, please do, because you're not watching the...
Oh, I'd be more than happy to come and walk around with you and raise some of these points. They've been well done. I mean, we haven't got quite time here, but I think there are many, many questions that can be addressed to CNN. Very serious questions, because I think the same problems will arise the next time around. When you say, you know, the role is not really to have peacenics, you've had... I mean, Amy, it's had actually... There was a very good quote from a retired general on... during the war, where he was not Cessna, you see, your vice president for political affairs. He said, we bring generals on, we call them analysts. We don't bring them in as advocates. We actually talk to them about they're not there as advocates. Well, actually, some organization brought up a quote from a retired Lieutenant General Dan Benton on CNN. And here's what he said. It's scarcely objective commentary. As I listened to this press conference this morning with reports of rapes, burning villages being burned, and this particularly incredible report of blood banks, of blood being harvested from young boys for the use of Yugoslav forces, I just got madder and madder. The U.S. has a responsibility as the only superpower in the world, and when we learn about these things, somebody has got to stand up and say, that's enough, stop it, we aren't going to put up with this. That's the general you had on. Actually, he was relating a particularly ridiculous propaganda story put out by NATO that young boys were being forced to give blood to Serbian soldiers. That's what I mean when you say, actually, your guy was putting out something that was probably invented by PSYOPs. So you say correctly, it's impossible to challenge, or it's difficult to challenge a negative, but, you know, you've got a lot of defending to do, in my opinion.
I appreciate that. CNN is manipulated by... people around the world attempt to manipulate us every day from governments and militaries all over the world. And certainly CNN was victimized by much Serb propaganda during the war and Iraqi propaganda. And, propaganda is thrown at all of us every day, and we do our best to sort our way through it.
Notice you've said Serb propaganda, Iraqi propaganda. Don't you think you were victimized by U.S. Pentagon propaganda?
All governments are involved in propaganda campaigns, absolutely.
Mr. Jordan, let me ask you this question. The Committee to Protect Journalists just came out with their annual report about the number of journalists killed around the world in places like Sierra Leone, more than 30. A terrible story. But in counting the number of journalists who were killed in Yugoslavia, they do not include the people who were killed at RTS that night. And I want to ask you if you think that that is wrong, that they should be included as well. Not characterized as propagandists.
I think we need to be clear on what makes a journalist, the number of people who were killed in the building were security guards and makeup artists, things like that. But as I've made clear, CNN denounced the bombing of Serb TV, was opposed to it before it happened, even though it was known publicly that it was going to happen. And if the journalists who were in that building, and I've been to Serb TV twice since it's been bombed, they absolutely should be on that list.
Another question I had as we wrap up the discussion had to do with your meetings when you were in Yugoslavia. You said you were there a number of times with, for example, Goran Mladic, who is one of the leaders of Mira Markovic's Yugoslav United Left Party, which was very heavily involved with cracking down on the media. What kinds of discussions did you have with him?
I met with the president of Serbia, the foreign minister of Yugoslavia, many, many people, and the discussions were frank, forthright, animated, and tough at times, because CNN was targeted by the Serb propaganda machine in a way that I felt was unfair and inappropriate, and it put our people in great danger. We had people who were beaten. We had cars and equipment destroyed. And in the end, we lost over $1.5 million of equipment to the Serbs. And to prove that we're equal opportunity victims, NATO bombed one of our TV transmitters in Belgrade. So we took it from all sides during the conflict.
And just to recap, you do think if reporters were killed in RTS that they should be counted as reporters?
That's correct.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Abe DeBries from Belgrade, Yugoslavia, who first broke the story. Eason Jordan, president of CNN International, talking to us from Atlanta. And Alexander Coburn, who does the newsletter Counterpunch, a biweekly political newsletter, also well-known commentator and columnist. His pieces on this issue appeared yesterday in the San Jose Mercury News and other publications. Websites, Alexander Coburn?
Oh, to find out about Counterpunch, you can do www.counterpunch.org or dial 1-800-840-3683.
One more time, that 800 number?
1-800-840-3683.
And CNN website, Mr. Jordan?
CNN.com.
CNN.com. And Abe DeVries, do you have a website for the newspaper you write for, Trow?
Yes, and for everybody in the States who can read the Dutch language, it would be worthwhile to visit it. It's www.trouw, that's TROUW.NL.
That's www.trouw, TROUW.NL. You're listening. Thank you very much. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to Hollywood. We'll be speaking with a black filmmaker who is suing Hollywood. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Juan, again, I just wanted to remind our listeners that the Army did pull out of the program at the last minute. We were going to have a lieutenant colonel from PSYOPS operation at Fort Bragg. He actually had worked in both East Timor and Somalia. But this morning, when hearing further about the guests that were going to be on, they decided to pull out. Well, we're going to move on with the program today. I don't know what your plans are for the weekends, folks, but for some people, they are going to be paying attention to the Academy Awards. And today, we're going to take a look at that issue as well. There was an interesting piece in the paper the other day that we took a look at, the Los Angeles Times by Karen Grigsby Bates. It said, "The retrieved Oscars were still warm from the TV crew's lights at the press conference where they'd been displayed when the jokes began, all a variation of the same thing. That's about the only way a brother is going to get an Oscar in Hollywood." Well, that's a slight exaggeration, but the spirit of the observation isn't too far off the mark. In its 72-year history, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has been a bit, well, stingy in awarding its coveted little gold statuettes to actors who happen to be significantly browner than the general membership. Hattie McDaniel was the first person to win one in 1940, Best Supporting Actress, for her role as Scarlett O'Hara's devoted slave, Mammy, in 1939's Gone with the Wind. Since then, there have been so few more, well, we can name them all here. Sidney Poitier won his Best Actor in 1963 for his role as itinerant laborer Homer Smith in Lilies of the Field. Louis Gossett Jr. won Best Supporting Actor for his portrayal of a tough drill instructor in the 1982 movie An Officer and a Gentleman. Denzel Washington won Best Supporting Actor for his role as a slave-turned-soldier in 1989's Glory and is nominated this year for Best Actor for his depiction of boxer Reuben Hurricane Carter in The Hurricane. Whoopi Goldberg won Best Supporting Actress for her performance as a sharp-talking medium helping to find the killer of a New York banker in the 1990 film Ghost. Cuba Gooding Jr. won Best Supporting Actor for his 96 role as a show-me-the-money football player in Jerry Maguire. As Porky Pig would note, that's all, folks, until Willie Folgier found the filched Oscars that made him, temporarily anyway, the most Oscar-laden player in all of Los Angeles of any color. Well, we're joined right now by two people to talk about the situation for people of color in Hollywood, particularly today, looking at African-Americans. Jama Fanaka is with us, black filmmaker, graduate of UCLA Film School, and 1991 recipient of the NAACP Image Awards. He's written, directed, and produced six feature films, including The Penitentiary Series, Street Wars, and Soul Vengeance. He's suing major Hollywood film companies, and we're joined by his lawyer, Irving Meyer. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Well, Jama Fanaka, tell us the basis of your suit.
Well, the basis of my suit is that Hollywood, for decades, have had hiring practices that violate the law. It's apropos that we follow your segment on PSYOPs, because PSYOPs, or the procedures of PSYOPs, or the concept of PSYOPs, also apply not only to war, but to peace. Once you get the mind, the heart will follow. And so I took the president's initiative on race, the report of the president's initiative on race, to heart when they said that the media is the key to racial harmony in America, because the media influences all institutions. The media influences the family, the media influences the church, the media influences the school. And for the media to be, as the NAACP recently said, the most racist industry in America is a national disgrace.
Well, could you tell us a little bit about your experience in Hollywood in terms of getting the artistic works, the film works that you want to produce made real?
Yes. Well, I, in 1994, founded the African-American Steering Committee of the Directors Guild of America. Once I founded that body, I was very serious about changing the landscape, employment landscape for minority filmmakers. That's all minority filmmakers, the Latinos. By the way, are you the same Juan Gonzalez that wrote A Harvest of Empire?
Yes, I am, yes.
Hey, great book, bellwether for the 21st century.
Well,
I wanted to mention that. But after I founded the African-American Steering Committee, I educated myself, and I found out that in 1981, the studios and networks agreed to include Article 15-201 into its collective bargaining agreement. Now, Article 15-201 says, and I quote, "Producers, that means all the signatories of the collective bargaining agreement of the Directors Guild, shall make good faith efforts to increase the number of working women and ethnic minority directors." Since that time, minorities, the employment of minorities has gone down. Women have gone up from a minuscule 3% to a very, very small 8%. So that means that 88% of the jobs go to white males. 8% to white females, 4% to all minorities. And I decided that someone, somewhere, had to take a stand. And I initially filed my class action lawsuit in pro per. I was able to educate myself in the intricacies of the law because of the Internet and because of a system called LexisNexis,
right,
which allows the layperson, you know, we don't have any rights that we don't have the wherewithal to protect. I mean, you know, you see on Cops all the time when you see people say, I know my rights. But, you know, you might know your rights, but they don't mean anything unless you have the wherewithal to protect those rights. So I set about this litigation, and we recently won a major victory thanks to the excellent attorney who's on the other line, Irving Meyer. We won a major victory in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. They reinstated our class action lawsuit with gusto.
Irving Meyer is with us, Jamal Fanak, and I wanted to ask him the grounds on which it was first dismissed and then reinstated. Attorney Irving Meyer.
Sure. It was initially it was dismissed because of some technical pleading inadequacies. So the judge in Los Angeles thought two things the judge said were lacking in Mr. Fanaka's complaint. One was the fact that Mr. Fanaka had actually stated and shown that he had applied for approximately 2,300 jobs as a director for motion pictures and for television shows, and did not receive one offer, in spite of Mr. Fanaka's experience, did not receive one offer. The judge said, oh, it's impossible for Mr. Fanaka to have applied for 2,300 jobs. Well, in fact, he did. He did it just the way the system requires you to apply for the jobs, and that is to let the studios know and the networks know that you're available to do these shows that are in the process of being produced. The other thing that the court said that was inadequate was that Mr. Fanaka did not state the number of minorities who applied for a director's job with the studios and or the networks. And that, in fact, is an impossible statistic because no one keeps it, number one. And number two, which is more important, is the fact that minorities over the years have learned and know that the studios and the networks have discriminated against them and are not, in fact, interested in them as to be a director of films or television shows, and therefore there's no reason for them to apply because it's just a fruitless effort for them to apply. So even if there were statistics, they would be unreliable as to the number of minorities who were capable of, who were interested in those jobs because they're discouraged from applying. So we're in the process of putting together a Sixth Amendment complaint in which we will put all of that information together. We're going to pare down the number of jobs that Mr. Fanaka applied for, although we're going to include the 2,300 jobs. But we're going to clarify a smaller number to show the judge just that Mr. Fanaka applied for these jobs because Mr. Fanaka did not get those jobs didn't even get an interview for those jobs in spite of the fact of Mr. Fanaka's major accomplishments as a director, which far exceed just about most. I'm not talking about maybe a film like Titanic, but most of the films that are directed by directors, a lot of whom are first-time directors. So that's where we are right now.
Well, Jamal Fanaka, what do you make of this the recent hullabaloo between a lot of the television networks and the NAACP and the National Council of La Raza and other groups in terms of them suddenly now saying, okay, we're going to make a commitment to actually move on hiring directors, actors, and people in all other aspects of at least the production of television shows. Do you sense that this is any that this is substantive or real, or is this just an immediate reaction that will go like many of the others, and in a few years it'll slip back into the status quo?
Well, firstly, I want to say I support the NAACP and La Raza and the other efforts of the civil rights organizations to bring Hollywood into compliance with law, the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But I do not trust Hollywood, and I have good reason not to trust Hollywood. First of all, the agreements reached by the NAACP et al. Have no provisions for enforcement. They are not binding. And Hollywood, back in 1981, as I said, for the first time included Article 15-201 into its collective bargaining agreement, which contractually obligated Hollywood to apply good faith efforts to increase the number of minority and women filmmakers. And we lost ground. As a matter of fact, I'm going to give you a scoop right now about the felonious federal crimes that the Directors Guild of America, my former union, committed against me in order to silence me and kick me out of the DGA. They charged me with doing ridiculous things, like at meetings, like they charged me with standing up and calling people MFs and charging the stage and scaring the top executives at one meeting. Pure, unadulterated BS. And I can prove it. Because my parents, who are in their 80s now, have taught me from the time I was a child, never go into a lion's den wearing a pork chop suit. So each time I went to the DGA, I had a tape recorder recording each and every word I said. Each and every time I addressed a fellow DGA member, I said, my brother, not MF. My brother.
Maybe they translated it that way.
Yeah. They conveniently translated it that way. I have taken these federal crimes to the office of the U.S. attorney here in Los Angeles, Alexandra Mayorkas, and he has assured me that he is going to vigorously investigate. This is what they did to me can be compared to the police scandal. It's no different. The only difference is that they attempted to murder my reputation and my name and my credibility in order to undermine my lawsuit.
Jim Afanaka,
they did it by committing the crimes of perjury, subordination of perjury, conspiracy, intimidation of witnesses,
falsification
of documents.
Let me just ask as we go out, which movie companies are you suing?
Every one of them. Every major studio and every television network.
Universal, MGM.
Universal, MGM, the Spielberg companies.
Warner Brothers.
ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, the Warner Brothers Channel. I'm suing
Disney
them all.
And Paramount.
They are all in violation of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Jim Afanaka, filmmaker, maker of Penitentiary, Street Wars, Soul Vengeance, suing the major Hollywood film companies, and his attorney, Irving Meyer. If people want to get in touch with you, where can they call or go on the web?
Okay, I'm right now making a website called Pro Se Can You See. It will be up soon. But my email address is Fanaka, F-A-N-A-K-A, at AOL.com.
Okay.
My number is 310-833-2367.
Well, thank you very much for
thank
being
you,
with
and
us.
God bless
That's 310-833-2367. And it does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love, Maria Carrion, and Karen Palmer. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. You can write to us at democracy@pacifica.org. Hear our show on the web and get more information and all these websites at www.democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!